Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Lincoln on Lending, a weekly mortgage market update providing up-to-the-minute information on interest rates, loan programs, and hot industry news relating to the mortgage industry. Brought to you by Mortgage Banking Solutions, enabling executives to take their business to the next level. To participate in today's program, our guest call-in line is 646-716-4972. And now, here is your host of Lincoln on Lending, David Lincoln.
Good to have you with us, everybody. It is April 6th, 7th. My gosh, how time flies. Anyway, we're good to have you. So glad to have you with us on the broadcast again. There's so much to talk about. We're continuing our discussion as we had last week with the roundtable of the regulars that are on the broadcast. This is really interesting because it's one of the more listened to broadcasts on a repeated basis. We appreciate you tuning in to be a part of the broadcast. Very special thank you goes out to our very special sponsors, as they are United Guaranty is serving our industry for over 50 years. Again, I really encourage you to go check out, we've been saying this repeatedly, but I mean, I really encourage you to go out and find the website, you know, ugcorp.com, and or go to our website, lincolnonlending.com, on the upper right-hand corner, click on their ad there, and it'll take you direct to their website. Get a hold of one of their agents. Their people are so valuable and so helpful to the industry. I mean, and not only that, I can't tell you what a great group they are. I've met with so many of them. We've had several of them on the broadcast. But really what I want to focus your attention on is we're going to be talking with Alice here shortly about QMI. And the QM and what they have is called the QMI product suite of services. And I want you to get familiar with what United Guaranty is doing. Appreciate them very much. Thank you, United Guaranty, for being a sponsor of the broadcast. Also, Velma.com. Velma stands for Virtual Electronic Marketing Assistant. They are a regular sponsor and a partner of us. They are have a electronic marketing solution that is just second to anything I've seen. I was so excited about it that we partnered with them on the radio program. So we're very pleased to have them. I think if you're looking for an innovative way in which to getting the message out, your marketing message out, you need to get to know and talk to Brent Emler there at Velma. It's a great service. And not only that, it's going in the way of using video tools. You can use videos as a part of your email. And the way they do it, and we had that, Brent, on the broadcast a few weeks ago, and Andy Schell, the Profit Doctor, said something really important. He says, now I get it why they're so valuable, why you're so excited about having them as a service, because the way they code in logos, for example, they get through the filters and they get on the targeted audience website or desktop on your email. Very cool stuff that they're doing, very inventive, very innovative, and I tell you, I encourage you to get a hold of them. Go out to the website, Velma.com, and without further ado, let's get into what's going on with a market update. Joe Farr, good to have you on the broadcast.
Hey, David. Thank you. It's a good morning.
It is a good morning.
Yeah, we're up 8:30 seconds. We've been a little higher. We touched up 12 for a brief period of time, but we've seen lots of favorable price changes and running a couple days in a row here with good MBS prices. Unfortunately, the stock market's down, but down 120 points. But this is just continuing last Friday's move after the jobs report. We saw an improvement in MBS prices of about 13/32. The Dow fell 150 points, and all this was on 192,000 net new jobs. The consensus was for 200,000. So the question is, why did we have such a nice improvement in MBS prices, and why did the Dow react the way it did when things came in so close to consensus? But Dave, part of it seems to be that there were whisper numbers up there for a bigger number. Some people were looking for as much as 300,000, expecting some weather-related increases, you know, as jobs
the weather warms up,
January and February. In fact, February jobs, when restated, were net new jobs were more in February than in March. So a little odd. And when you dig into the jobs created, you're going to find a lot of low-quality jobs, you know, part-time jobs. And wage growth was non-existent. And so, you know, even though it was a good number, it was not that good a report. the only good news in the report to speak of was that more people entered the labor market than, well, just more people entered it to the tune of keeping the unemployment rate where it was. And the labor force participation rate did rise to the highest level in 6 months. So, you know, as people see the opportunity and they enter the labor market, that's generally a good sign. But as I said, the unemployment rate stayed at 6.7%. It was interesting. The Dow had reached an all-time high on Friday morning, prior to or just after the jobs report came out. But by the end of the day, it had lost 150 points. Last week, you know, we talked last Monday about Yellen's comments, so I won't go over that again. But the rest of the economic data during the week was, you know, pretty consistent with what was expected. Had very little net impact on mortgage rates, but both the ISM indexes came in a little higher than they were in February, and factory orders were good. The unemployment claims did rise. That was a little disappointing. And, you know, we talked about the ECB as a potential market-moving event last week, and they really didn't move the market. They did not change their interest rates, but they seemed to position themselves for the potential to do some form of bond buying or quantitative easing of some sort. So we might see more from them in the weeks ahead. All in all, last week, MBS prices improved 50 basis points. So, like I said, a good week.
Good week, yeah. So this labor force, I read a report that they're expecting the labor force to grow by 8.5 million over the next 8 years. Does that sound like a big number to you, Joe, or is that just kind of a normal growth? I wasn't sure how to read that number.
It's always interesting to hear which survey or which report they're coming from. That sounds like a big number. But
that
then
does
you
sound
hear
like
about
a big number to me, too, yes.
You hear about the numbers that are created, generated through the unemployment rate survey, and you know they're talking about 400,000 or 500,000 jobs created, and a large number also losing jobs. So it sounds like a big number, and it would be a great thing to happen if we see it happen. But I don't have a good opinion as to whether that can be achieved.
Well, it'd be interesting to find out. See, well, yeah, that seemed like a fairly big number to me. That's what I wanted your opinion. So. Interesting.
Yeah. So this week we get Janet Yellen's and your new favorite report, the Jolts Report, comes out tomorrow. And the minutes come out on Wednesday. And each of the last couple of minutes have had a negative impact on mortgage prices. So, you know, not big, but you might pay attention at 2 o'clock on Wednesday. And then PPI comes out at Friday at 8:30. Treasury auctions, the Wednesday auction is the 10-year, so be looking at that. And I wanted to take a little step back and just take a little bigger view of MBS prices and treasury yields, longer-term treasury yields. And really for all of this year, we've been in a fairly tight range. Treasury's been in a very tight range with yields that, you know, going down to, 265 and then rising to 280. But, you know, that's a pretty narrow range. And this sounds like a bigger range, but MBS prices have been in the middle of a 200-point range all of this year. That's not to say things hadn't been volatile. I went back and looked at March, and one of the big correspondent lenders issued 23 different price change sheets during the month of March over 21 days, so they averaged more than one per day. So things have been moving, but they just hadn't been moving in real large amounts. So we've stayed in this fairly narrow range, and really don't have a real push to break out of that range until we get much stronger economic data and inflation rises. Of course, that's pushing out the wrong way, meaning rates would rise, MBS prices would fall. And then there's always a chance of, you know, the Ukrainian situation escalating or China's economy falling apart or the Fed doing something a little bit crazy. But, you know, all in all, we've been, like I said, in a fairly narrow range at a fairly low rate and wouldn't mind staying here for a while longer.
Yeah, it'll be interesting if we do. What are your thoughts as far as it relates to the auction? Last week, the auction was really strong, and it actually drove mortgage rates down because they saw the flow. I mean, my presumption was they saw the flow of money flowing into bonds, and which seemed to signal a flight to quality. But
we're seeing that. Since the Friday jobs report, I mean, there's a lot of concern about the absolute strength of the economy, and with stocks being where they are, they're pretty expensive right now, and takes a pretty significant improvement in the economy to support those levels. So there has been that movement. We might see a reversal of that. Of course, if we do, MBS prices will benefit.
Yes. Well, there's so much. There are so many factors that go into which way the direction of the mortgage rates are, and we just touch on it here, but you really need to come in. I study this service. The MBS quote line service is something I study. The graphs that are in there, how you can measure things, how you can look at things. I tell you, folks, it is really something of real value. And again, the part that I like about it is it doesn't give me some information I don't need and fill me up with my head with a bunch of data points. It just gets me right to the point of where the market's moving. Appreciate you being with us, Joe. It's always fun to have
Thanks, Dave.
Comment. And you're going to be part of the whole broadcast. Folks, by the way, we're going to be changing up the broadcast. We're going to go to Paul Muller right after the break. But we're going to be changing up the broadcast a bit. We're going to be going into the roundtable topic. Rather than going to each one of the topics and then dive into it again, we're just going to expand out each one of the normal topics. So we're going to get in just a minute with Paul, get him on the radio, give us an update on the headlines, and then we're going to get into Tony Garitano. Then we're going to get with Alice. So we're kind of putting Tony in the top. I'm really excited to talk to Tony Garitano because of all that's going on with LMA last week. A lot of headline issues there. So I can't wait to get him on. So very good. That's the order of the day. That's we're changing it up just a bit. So for those who are regular listeners going, whoa, what happened? Something's different. Joe, thank you so much. Folks, we'll be right back after this brief break.
Looking for that competitive edge? MBS Quoteline delivers live market coverage for originators. Get up-to-the-minute mortgage market news and analysis as events occur.
Get MBS prices as trades happen.
Straight to your computer, email, cell phone, or PDA. Know in advance when your investors will reprice. Make better lock-float decisions and increase your income. Be the expert your clients expect and know what's moving interest rates right now, tomorrow, and beyond. MBS Quoteline, delivering live market coverage for originators. Learn more about MBS Quoteline today at MBSQuoteLine.com.
MBSQuoteLine.com.
646-716-4972. The Lincoln on Lending Show is back. Here is your host, David Lincoln.
It must be the breathing of that, Paul Mallow on the phone. I heard him just a little bit ago. Joe, good to have you on the broadcast as it is. Always, what's the headlines you got for us you're tracking, my friend?
Well, we had a lot of neat stories last week on Ellie Mae. I think IMF News broke the story about their tech snafu. I'd be interested to hear what Tony Garitano has to say about what happened. Late last week, we were hearing that Ellie Mae probably or should contact the FBI about that data attack on their Encompass platform. A very interesting story. I talked to a couple different lenders. Obviously some guys were angry. They might want compensation from Ellie Mae, but I talked to a few who also said, we're not going to seek compensation because, it wasn't their fault, and took sort of that kind of attitude. So that was nice to see. Interesting story. We wrote about that more on Friday than today. Today in the headlines, we got banks and thrifts. Their secondary marketing activity really took a dive last year. Loan sales fell 38%. This is banks and thrifts, which is interesting
really?
Because loan production didn't fall by that much. It fell more like 20%. So, the feeling is that, and I've been hearing about this for a while, more depositories are keeping their mortgages.
Yeah.
And I guess the question is, are they keeping 30-year fixed-rate loans? Are they keeping ARMs? Are they keeping 15s? These are jumbos. Are they 7 years? And as you know, Dave, you go way back like me. You remember the days where, you never, ever borrowed short and lended long on your deposits and your mortgages. But I got to tell you, if you actually had borrowed short and lent long for the last 25 years, you'd have done really well.
Yeah.
Regulators
yes.
would have been all over you like a cheap suit. But you would have made a ton of money. It's sort of interesting.
But it's those corrections that just kill you. It's just it's when those markets shift as they do, and they do suddenly, that's when you get really hit. So, yeah, it's one of those things. Those, but we're wondering if anything was learned in the last S&L crisis. It's so far, seems so far ago. You know, you and I are much younger men back in that day.
Yeah, I mean, listen, I covered the S&L mess, too. And the I mean, they had that mismatch, obviously. But, you know, the answer was not to deregulate S&Ls and let them do whatever the heck they wanted. And, you know, crazy commercial lending like Charlie Keating, who recently passed away, the Lincoln Savings scandal and all that stuff. But that's a – you could do a whole show on that one. But also in the headlines today, we have a little bit of a preview on how ugly the first quarter is. FBR came up with some numbers using IMF data, and they're looking at a first quarter production number of I think about $226 billion, which annualizes less than $1 trillion for the year. Last year, the entire business did $1.8 trillion. You know, FBR sees things picking up in the middle two quarters of the year, and I talked to quite a few lenders last week. You know, there's a feeling out there. There's a lot of small and medium-sized guys who are just barely hanging on. They're going to have to do something in the next quarter, you know, either sell, partner, get rid of their servicing, or make a real run on the purchase business. Otherwise, we're going to see a lot of casualties. So that's going to be something to watch. We also had some broker numbers. On the hiring loan brokers, the broker employment actually went up slightly, but mortgage banker employment fell. The whole employment situation is obviously an interesting trend to watch. We also talked to a guy named Andrew Henschel. He runs a thing called RPM. He's in the buyback defense business, and he sees, even though Fannie and Freddie have gone through a lot of their buybacks, he's seeing a pickup in buybacks from credit unions, from Fannie and Freddie, and he expects FHA can't do buybacks, but he expects to see them ask for more indemnifications from mid-sized banks and whatnot. We also pulled some Ocwen numbers. You know, Ocwen is, of course, a fascinating story on many different
levels.
But, you know, on Friday their board voted these fancy relocation packages for some of their executives to relocate to the U.S. Virgin Islands where the servicing unit is, I guess. They also boosted the bonuses. But we decided to pull the in short takes, we have a little bit about Ocwen's compensation. Ocwen spent $442 million last year in compensation and salaries. That's a really large number. The year before it was like $150 million or something like that. It grew by like 260%. I mean, they've had huge growth, but, I mean, their compensation numbers are enormous. You know, I don't know if you know much about that.
Does it break out what Bill Irby's numbers are?
Well, I started pulling the queue just before I went to press. I only had time to look at a few things. I plan on doing a deeper dive on their compensation, but Bill is obviously... he's got to be raking in the dough there. So, one last thing, this new advocacy group that popped up over the weekend, it's called the Coalition of Mortgage Security. You know, it sounds like, you know, they want to do good things for the American consumer, and, you know, they want privatization of Fannie and Freddie, and they also want the 30-year fixed-rate mortgage to survive, so figure that one out. But they also want the shareholders more or less to be compensated. And, you know, it seems like it's probably the hedge funds disguised as this do-gooder group. You know, and there was another group that came out recently with the same deal. I mean, it's basically the hedge funds coming up with these phony baloney, you know, advocacy groups to, you know, further home finance lending. What they're really doing is saying, you know, please pay us for our big speculation in Fannie Freddie common and preferred stock. It's almost a joke. And I hope either we or the Wall Street Journal or both can dig out who's backing these groups, because I think it's a fascinating story.
Fascinating. So. It's hilarious. I mean, I don't know how you avoid being more cynical. I mean, I'm getting more cynical with age as I'm 40 years in this industry, Paul. And I listen to that and I go, let me see, we're going to help the consumers and we're going to kill the only secondary market the industry has, and there's no real plan to do anything more. So let's kill Fannie and Freddie. In the meantime, we – that this suspicious we group are going to be out there picking up, raking it in. So, I mean, costs will go up to consumers. Interest rates will go up. The product, the 30-year mortgage, well, what could happen to that? I tell you, it's just really fascinating. I mean, dive into that story, would you? There's got to be some really juicy stuff there.
Well, we'll see what we can do.
Well, folks, if you have
I look
not,
forward to hearing Tony later on talking about.
Yeah, he's going to be on next, so stay right
see
on the
next.
Line.
Okay.
You'll get to, I'm going to have him on right after you. We're not even going to go to an ad break, so we're going to bring him on. So hang on in there, and then, in fact, we'll leave your mic on if you want to chime in on a little bit on this because it's such a big story, and then collaborative. I like kind of like to get your input on it. So with that, let's jump right over. But before I go there, I want to go IMF News. www.imfnews.com. Plural.com. Head out to the website if you haven't done so already. And again, I keep saying this, if you're looking for a place to advertise and get your brand out everywhere, this is the place to do it. Great place to advertise. So, Paul, thanks so much. Let's keep your mic
on.
I'll
keep
it on.
I don't want to hear Tony talk. I don't want to steal his time.
Well, I know, but if you have something, you can. Alice is co-producing this with me. She's running the button, so we're going to leave your mic on if you want to jump in on something of that nature. But let's go to Tony. Tony, good to have you on the broadcast. We always love having you on, but there's never been a time that's more timely than now, with especially this topic of what happened to Ellie Mae. It's like there's two things that are unique about this: the market share that they have, and then the fact that this could happen. So, Tony, I've got to get my questions out here. So my first question is, what happened to Ellie Mae this last week? What's your twist on this, your story? I read what Paul wrote last week, but what's your take on it?
Yeah, and I think, and to Paul's credit, I think that was the first place that I read the story last week as well. So kudos to IMF
Paul.
And to Paul for scooping people on that. But what happened was there were a bunch of calls made to the Ellie Mae Encompass system.
Let's go, for those that are not technically minded, when you say calls, is it phone calls or it is a system access? I mean, someone's system accessing Ellie Mae's system. Is that what you mean by calls?
Correct. Yeah, they're system-to-system calls.
Folks. Let's just make sure we got that straight. All right. So there was a number of calls or a computer dialing in or trying to connect with their system that set this off. So go ahead. Go on.
Right.
I'm sorry.
And it caused a huge disruption that went on, as you know, everybody knows, the end of the month at the end of the first quarter.
Talking about the worst possible time possible.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of lenders were quite literally prohibited or unable to close loans because of the fact that the system, you know, was down because of these multiple calls that had caused a system disruption. What's interesting, you know, we talked a little bit about this offline, Dave, is that Ellie Mae has publicly come out and said that the calls were mortgage specific, meaning that the entity that made the calls either had direct knowledge of the mortgage industry and of the type of calls that the Encompass system usually receives, or they did research and found out, you know, how to make mortgage-specific calls that the Encompass system would normally receive. So the reason why that's significant is because Encompass didn't know the difference. They thought they were legitimate calls.
Yeah, so the system got hacked the profit doctors always talk about this. You know, what controls do you have in place? How do you stress this? And we'll get his take on this a little bit later in the broadcast. But I mean, that's a huge, huge, huge issue. So, is this in your mind, Tony? I mean, it's so easy to throw sticks and stones. I mean, Ellie Mae has got a huge system. I know they're conscientious about this, but you know, one of the things that there has been, it's no secret that Ellie Mae is envied and hated because of their success, or envied for hated for other reasons. The articles that were reported that were out there were that they think it is. They said Ellie Mae's own words. They think it was someone within the industry. They said the actual words, a competitor. which implied someone active in the business. And I thought that was fascinating. I was reading the article. That came from the American Banker this morning when I was reading it on the flight on my airplane ride. So go ahead.
To your point, Dave, I mean, Ellie Mae has a reputation in the industry. I think it could be that it was a competitor or that it was someone that was disgruntled with Ellie Mae that has moved on. I mean, I think that that's just speculation, and we'll see where that goes. That could also just be Ellie Mae trying to make excuses. You never know. We're not privy to that information. I mean, what I took away from it was the fact that Ellie Mae touts that a lot of their growth comes from those clients that use the software as a service system, which is a web-based, internet-accessible version of Encompass. And, in fact, you know, as I've talked to both you and Paul and other people in the not-too-distant future, that's where the mortgage industry is going in terms of its technology over the past few years. So as the industry migrates to more internet-based systems, this sort of thing is going to happen more and more and more. And it seems to me that for a company that has such huge market share as Ellie Mae, they need to be on top of this. And not only does Ellie Mae need to be on top of this, but really every system active in the mortgage industry today needs to be on top of it. And on top of that, lenders can't just expect that the technology vendor is going to take care of it either.
Yeah.
So there's Tony, this is Paul. Real quick question. Ellie Mae's got like a 60% market share or whatever, I think. That's just an aside. Does anyone think that maybe some people have been short-selling Ellie Mae's stock to this to drive it down?
I have not heard that, Paul.
Okay.
But I know that obviously their stock is taking a bath because of this, but that's not what I heard.
Okay. Thank you.
I heard some theories on that, Paul. So, I mean, I heard some theories on this, and the fact that there's been a statement that you don't usually release a statement that there's a competitor did this. That's what that article read this morning. I believe it's an American Bank.
And that
American
was based
Bank.
On an official statement, too, Dave.
That was based on official?
Yeah, they made an official statement to that effect.
So that is pretty interesting. And I think this tees off a whole bunch of things. So is two questions I have for you. I mean, I want to get into how can you avoid this, but the big question is the SaaS model in jeopardy now? Is there people are going to look at this and they're going to say the service, software as a service, you know, transactional hosted, is this really going to be reexamined? Do you think something, you know, we could see this being a affecting a change in that type of business model?
I don't think so, Dave. The industry has been going this way for several years. A lot of the systems are already in place. And, you know, we all know how lenders are very reluctant to switch their systems in general.
Right.
I think that the software as a service systems certainly are easier to switch just by the nature of how they're configured if they wanted to do that. But I think that the transactional model and the scalability of these types of systems makes them more cost-effective for lenders. They're also easier to implement in some cases, depending on the system that you're talking about. So I don't think it's going to go away. And this is not just an isolated incident when it comes to software as a service systems, Dave, because in general what's happening is the regulatory bodies, whether it be the CFPB or the GSEs, you know, or other state and local regulators, they're requiring lenders to be more data-driven. They want the appraisals electronically. They want, you know, disclosures electronically. They want loan-level data delivered electronically. So whether you're delivering that data through a software as a service model or not, the lender has to be increasingly conscious of what happens to that data. So in my view, this is just, you know, it could have happened at any time. Unfortunately, it happened to Ellie Mae. It's going to happen in the future, and vendors and lenders need to understand that they're not immune, which I think is a problem in our industry.
Which really goes to my last question. We got to move through this pretty quickly, but again, how can this be avoided? Can this be avoided? I mean, if you're, what could they do anyway?
Well,
how do we
avoid
this in the future?
There are systems and services out there that can be bolted on to your core systems. There are different encryptions. There's, you know, PKI and other strategies that lenders can employ. But what they should also do is ask their vendors what their vendors are currently doing. So find out what your vendor's doing, and then find out what you can do on top of that.
Wow.
I mean, the thing about hackers is, you know, similar to when you talk about fraudsters. You know, they're always going to find a new, better way to do it. So I don't think it's possible for anyone to be immune, because there's always going to be a new strategy or a new method that comes up. But for you to stick your head in the sand and not even talk about it and not even make plans to deal with it, which I think is the case in our industry, is very, very short-sighted.
Yeah. There, I can't wait to get Andy Schell on this topic. We're going to run over to him after the break. But Paul and Tony, thank you so much. Paul, thanks for diving. Paul, get on this. Dive into this. This is tough. We got to find
out. I'm
going
to talk to Tony about this.
To sick him. Go after him. We got to get to the bottom of this. I mean, it's just too much. I mean, they have 60% market share. This, you look at the finance system, is really becoming dependent on these guys, and there is much to write about, much to talk about, and much planning that needs to go into it. So both of you, thank you so much. Tony, it's always fun to have your insights on these things, and we'll continue this dialogue for probably weeks to come, but we appreciate you both being here.
Thanks, Tony.
Thank you, Dave. Thank you, Paul.
Thank you, guys. Appreciate it. We'll let the both of them off the line here, and then you know what? We're going to take a quick ad break. And Alice, let's go in. We're going to open up your topic because we're going to get there. But let's take a quick ad break, Alice, if you don't mind, and then we're going to be back. I want to tee up Andy because I want to continue with this topic on technology. So let's we'll be right back after this brief break.
Looking for a full-service mortgage training and consulting company to fit exactly what you need? Mortgage U is your ultimate education and information resource used by lenders to execute high-impact, high-quality training throughout the organization. Mortgage U instructors are mortgage professionals providing classroom and web-based delivery and has the most sought-after training manuals in the country. Mortgage U has a proven track record performing customized training programs for hundreds and even thousands of employees both live and online on everything from application through loan delivery and insuring. Call Mortgage U today at 800-278-0200 or visit us online at mortgage-u.com. Welcome back to Lickin' on Lending. Our guest call-in line is 646-716-4972. And now here's David Lickin.
Good to have you back. We're mixing up the order, everybody, because this is the roundtable discussion, and we're going to just mix it up a bit more. I plan to go to Alice, but after that discussion, one of the things that I want to get into is really some things that you, the lenders, can do to begin to manage against this risk. And the profit doctor isn't just a profit doctor on the bottom line of protecting your income. He's also big on consulting on the system side of it, and really things that can be done. So, Profit Doctor, I want to head over to you on this topic, if you wouldn't mind, getting into things that can be done from your perspective. I mean, we consult on this. This is not – you've been saying it's amazing that something like this hasn't happened more, especially now that we're at a SaaS model, software as a service, and we have a company like Ellie Mae with 60% of the market share. So talk to us, Profit Doctor.
Well, David, can you hear me okay?
Well, you sound like you're at the bottom of a well, so it's actually pretty bad. So
let me see if I can't get this is sorry.
Boy, that is – I can't even understand you. So while you're doing adjusting, Alice, we're going to shift over to you while Andy reconnects or does get something worked out there. Alice, your thoughts on this from the whole Ellie Mae thing. As I was reading the articles, and I was really wanted to get into this, but you know, CFPB, Alice, is really putting pressure on companies to be on top of all this. I mean, everyone say it's Ellie Mae's problem. No, it's not Ellie Mae's problem. It is also the company. So you're the head of compliance. What do you think we're going to start seeing? I mean, Heather, you're the one that reports,
right.
Gives us commentary. Everything compliance is what I mean. Do we anticipate CFPB just being all over this, like, you know, like Paul said, like a cheap suit?
Well, I like that analogy, but, you know, technically they don't have authority over Ellie Mae, but for all the lenders who were having to deal with those challenges, they're now faced with, okay, I thought that my biggest provider, you know, and my computer software connection, my company, my loan origination software company, that they would have the right systems in place and the right controls so that I can count on them. And in my vendor management process, did I have to really be focused on the biggest of the big, or was I supposed to be more focused on my mid-size or my smaller tier vendors? So I'll let Andy, when he gets back on the line, talk from a technology standpoint.
But
from a compliance standpoint, I'm very concerned as a lender that the biggest vendor I have in my shop, you know, which is going to be my LOS provider, is now a problem that I have to go, aside from all the headaches of all the loans and the money lost, you know, from a compliance standpoint, now I go, wow, great, that's a problem.
Vendor validation, we're
going
to get into that in a minute with
on?
Andy, but I want, he's back on, but I have a question for you, Alice. Is Ellie Mae considered a covered person? I mean, a covered entity? I mean, we talk about CFPB, there's covered and non-covered people. I mean, I thought it was you're a covered person, which means you fall under the jurisdiction of CFPB if you in any way, shape, or form touch borrower information. So are they covered?
Well, I think in my vendor management program, yes, I have to make sure I have my relationship with that vendor completely covered. So they're absolutely under that. But the CFPB doesn't have authority to go in and regulate Encompass. They regulate lenders and brokers.
They use them, yes. So that's
they would
more
be
of
coming
a,
in
a,
from that direction.
From that direction. Okay, you're back in. I don't know where you were. Boy, it sounds like you're at the bottom of a well. So give us your thoughts on all of this, because this is a big topic, vendor validation,
yeah,
vendor verification.
Absolutely. Well, thanks, Dan. Well, and Alice hit a couple of the key points. And I think our two biggest vendors that we need to be concerned with are our technology provider for our LOS and our subservicer. Those are two of the biggest that we need to be aware of. And in our vendor management program, we need to validate that our vendors are complying with all of the CFPB rules under the CFPB 2012-03 guidelines, which requires us as the lenders to perform due diligence to make certain that they have protocols in place to test that their consumer data is protected and so forth and so on. And then as a matter of course, it's important to have, this bulletin requires, KPI reporting from the vendor along with consequences upon failure. What happens if the vendor loses data or has something leak out?
Those are the consequences. There doesn't appear to be any of that going on here. They haven't said that they were hacked, that any borrower data was leaked per se or obtained. They had performance issues, as if I understand this. Their systems were just unable to function.
Well, that's where the rest of the business case comes together, because what I was citing was more specific CFPB guidelines under more general business management guidelines. And actually, these are included in the regulatory guidelines, the OCC guidelines, is that if they have service provider failures or service level failures, the CFPB guidelines are very, very basic of things you need to include. I would include substantially more than that and then go more on the lines of what the commercial banks require, which would include, for something like this kind of a failure, this kind of a data failure would have financial consequences and even contract termination provisions. That's what you need to have for some of these things. And the point that, oh, my gosh, it happened to Ellie Mae. It was some sort of nefarious activity. But, you know, poor them, they were just innocent and got hacked. I don't believe that for a second. We have service providers all around the country today who are providing SaaS-based services to customers, whether if it's the big banks, the multi-banks, you know, the multinational and national banks like Wells Fargo, Chase, B of A, or even down to the smaller banks, the SunTrusts, and even all the way down to the little bitty banks. They have the ability of providing access to data in a way that's a secure process. So what some of the problems that Ellie Mae had is that they had a poor deployment of some of the key elements, such as proper handshaking, proper vendor multi-factor identification, the proper encryption to make certain that the inbound calls were properly validated, and then the credential testing. You're supposed to have credential testing from all inbound calls. I mean, not phone calls, but when one server asks another server to let them in, there's supposed to be an encrypted access protocol that includes credential testing and oftentimes a multi-factor verification for the user to even be able to begin to get in. And so, you know, without getting all the way deep into the technical side of this, it sounds to me like Ellie Mae made some big mistakes. Because if it were possible to do this to everybody every day, it would be happening to everybody every day. And security, data security isn't something that you just do once and say, thank you very much, we're good. It's an ongoing, never-ending, forever-happening process, and it's a function of cost. Data security is expensive, and companies tend to underestimate the expense, and consequently, even at Target. You know, Target deployed a system a year ago that would have prevented the hacking from happening with the credit cards. The system was actually going off, and they ignored it. So
they talk about that. See, that is an important data point. That it when you we were talking about the were you talking about the Target one? Was the Target hack?
Target. Right.
And you said that they actually had systems in place, and it was sending off alarms like the pick your favorite alarm. It was going off, and they chose to ignore it and shut it off. If I understand correctly.
That's right. And so there are tools in place that detect hacking. There are tools in place to detect malware. There's tools in place that can detect proper inbound requests for data exchange and proper testing of the inbound data to make certain that it's the right people are asking the right questions. The credential testing and the encryption validating. I mean, those things are out there. People do it. I am far from an expert in it. I just see the deployment of it. But there's ways to have prevented this, I think. And I think Tony made the point that we as lenders need to understand how our vendors are going to protect themselves from situations like this. And we certainly need to ask the question. But even if we do ask the question, I suspect that today we would get an answer from Encompass that sounds legitimate. The trick is just, so go with a vendor that's committed to always maintaining data security and prevent things like this from happening. The problem is they have to invest in data security. You don't do it once and it's done. It's an ongoing commitment to cost. It's like compliance. It's just like, you know, we talked about the too big, too small to comply.
Comply, yes.
It's expensive to maintain all of the security that's needed to protect yourself on an ongoing daily basis going forward. And it reduces EPS, reduces earnings per share, because you spend more money on technology, spend more money on compliance and so forth and so on. So it's having a company whose commitment to managing the stability of the infrastructure is balanced with the focus on generating higher earnings and higher EPS. So there's always
Hey, Andy, I have a question. I have a question. So I'm a lender who uses we won't keep naming names here, but I'm a lender that uses a software provider that just had a major problem. Now, what is my next course of action in my vendor management? You know, when I try and think of the cost for me personally as a lender to hire a highly qualified technology auditor who's going to go in and try and audit my LOS provider to give me the reassurance that this isn't going to happen to them again, or I'm too small to be able to pay for that, so do I have to rely on that loan origination software provider to have a third-party auditor come in and tell me, are you okay now? How are you going to verify to me that this isn't going to happen again? What's your thoughts on that? Am I able to take that vendor's third-party auditor, or do I have to afford my own auditor to go in and turn over rocks and find out what went on? And when I get the report, I won't know anything what it says because I don't understand technology lingo.
Well, there's you're part of that too. But vendors like this should be having intrusion testing and event detection. There are vendors out there that make a living hacking. And vendors like Ellie Mae or the bank software services
and
like
legitimately,
Pfizer,
I mean legitimately,
yeah,
I mean
legitimately,
that's their job is to go test and try to hack.
That's right. And their job, and they get hired by the banks to come in and they say, hack my system. And then they look for backdoors. They look for ways to get around the encryption. They look for ways to trick the testing of the validity of the inbound request. And so that's part of the reports that you get. You want to ask for the SAA 16 and the SAS 70 reports, which relate to the data center, but then also ask for the penetration testing tests and the results and what were they. And you can get a report that actually the summary is kind of in English where you can read what it says. So I would ask Ellie Mae right now, send me your last penetration testing result within the last 6 months and let me see what it says. And hopefully they have one and hopefully they had a qualified vendor who tested it, because it seems to me that something like this should have been detected.
Avoidable.
This isn't my deepest area of expertise, but I work in this area a lot, and people deal with it. People control it. People address it. People have ways of avoiding it.
Well, we have Teresa on our staff that has deep, deep knowledge on this, and it's something that, I mean, we got to get Teresa on this, because I think we really need to continue this topic, because this one is not going to go away. This is a big issue, and it's one that, you know, I want every one of our listeners to be aware of what their responsibility is, which is we're focusing over, shifting our focus to you, Alice, a little bit on this. And this is thematic of whether it be any aspect of any failure of any systems, whether it be financial, whether they be whatever they are, this is something that I think is just a systemic problem with our industry. You're going, you know what, I do my best, I try. Well, you know what, I'm sorry, when you have something of this nature, trying is not going to cut it.
It's really speeding. I was just at a customer recently who is very old-fashioned still. Traditional mortgage shop has been around literally since the 40s. And a lot of their systems, you walk in, you feel like you just took a step back in time to the 80s using NCR forms. And an event like this just makes them go, see, we're better off. You know, this is not helping my case that they need to automate all their disclosures.
Yeah.
Automated.
It's really true. It's really, 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 really true. It's fascinating to see those that are holding on to the old ways are going, see there, that's a great point, Alice. Really, really good point.
Well, we
got 12 minutes left of this broadcast. We're probably going to have to continue this on. I want to shift focus over to you, Alice, some of the things that on the roundtable discussion. Again, it's quarter in. We have a huge issue. Andy talked about fat tails. This is a fat tail that really hit, a statistical fat tail that hit probably this. We didn't think was much, but it's there. But this is not alone. And so let's talk about some of the regulations that's coming down. One of the questions I had for you, and I think this is it seems like a rhetorical question, Alice, but, you know, are we going to see the tsunami? Is what we thought was a tsunami, which is a one wave that washes over the landscape, alters the landscape, is this really the new tidal waves? Is this really the new tidal patterns, if you're going to go to a wave on the beach? And some thought this was just a tsunami, but isn't this the new tides? Isn't this the new tide levels? Is we're going to have these kind of waves of this on an ongoing basis? Talking about regulation.
I think we do have waves coming in for sure for this year. And I think what I would include in that is the legal side. So in terms of how many new rules are coming out, we all know we still have several still on the docket with the QRM pending, although that one isn't going to have as big of a seismic change as we'd originally hoped, thanks to the efforts of the industry there. We certainly have HMDA changes. We have the disclosure changes, the combined disclosures coming up. So I would agree with you. This is our new, more like a level, not a tsunami.
The new, yeah, the new world.
Yeah. This, but
the new reality.
Still have, so much unknown, right, for the legal side. So we could very well, after this pipeline of loans gets a little seasoned, if we have any kind of economic downturn that would cause an uptick in the foreclosure rates at all, or even if they're just sustaining at the rate they are now and we're not getting improvement in the foreclosure, right, we're still not down to where we should be. We're still high national averages. And if it stays at this level, then we have some increased legal risk that we definitely have to watch out for, and that's what's causing the QM fear out there for customers as they still try and decide how much they want to dip their toe into the non-QM world. So that's my two cents on that. I think, yeah, this is our new level, but we still could have tsunamis of different regulations as we look to next year and the year after if we get some non-performing loans. I mean, we will.
Yeah.
I do want to give folks a quick heads up, Dave, on the homeownership counseling disclosure. The homeownership counseling disclosure that we have to give out on loans now, I've seen a lot of folks are giving not a list, but they're just giving the link. And, you know, that was just a temporary window, and we're going on 90 days now since the June 10th, right, deadline, or June 10th implementation of the regs. And I would just implore people to actually give the consumer a list of housing counseling agencies and not just the link. Just a quick heads up, I wanted to make sure was part of my update.
That's important, yeah.
Because that's coming up on April 10th, would be about 90 days, and the regulator's going to go, look, you've had 90 days to get this worked out. You really should be giving the customer a full list instead of just the link there. So that's my two cents on that.
Very, very good. I had the question that you were, I'm having a senior moment, I had a question at the tip of my tongue about what you were talking about earlier about the tsunami. Oh, I know what it was. It had to do with QM. And we're seeing a number of banks doing non-QM, and Paul reported this, the number of activity in the secondary markets. He reported on this, and it's a great article. Everyone should go out and read that. Go to imfnews.com and read that article, because the number of the secondary market activity is down, which means the implication, and we know banks, you have clients that are banks, Alice, and we do, Andy and I have clients that are starting to do more non-QM lending, and they have the ability to do it. It's a really the opportunity. I don't know if credit unions are really getting into it. I'm not sure I've seen any credit unions doing it, but certainly community banks are going into it. Any words of wisdom that you have for them, or any thoughts you have towards that?
Well, I think there is a definite value in being in that space as long as everyone is fully aware that we cannot predict the legal challenge outcome. So you only have the ability to predict the historical trend of that product if you say, I'm going to keep doing what I have been doing. Maybe I put some tighter controls around, you know, restricting loan to values, having tighter controls over defining my portfolio underwriting characteristics. But someone has to try and make an assertion of now that, or as time goes on, borrowers will have more knowledge about their legal right to sue for the ability to repay or lack of the lender identifying their ability to repay. That's an unpredictable landscape in the future. And just keeping that in mind will help you make sure you've got the right analysis and loan loss reserves. So I think I love to see that community lending market go
right
that route. I don't think it's going to be on a large scale yet because of that factor. You know, how do you account for that probability, you know, within borrowers suing in the event that they go into default?
Right.
So good controls help, yeah.
Yeah, so, I mean, Alice, that is, are you seeing banks contacting you? Or are you seeing banks going into it? What my data point is I'm seeing a number of banks that are just starting to get into it and do it, but I asked them, some of our clients at least, what thought went into it? How much have you really looked at it from
right
a regulatory standpoint? And I get some, yeah, we've looked at it, but we really need the volume, Dave. And so there seems to be more of a cry and a motivation to get lending activity going. And some of the margins on this product, especially at their borrowing rates and what they're lending this out at, it's really profitable business. But I'm wondering if they're more focused on volume and earnings than the potential risk that they're taking on. Your thoughts on that, and then I want to get Andy's thoughts on that.
I would agree that, you know, it's because it's unknown, they're going to lean on, well, historically, you know, our default rate would have only been, you know, less than 1%, and I have a closely held customer relationship with my clients. I don't believe that we would, you know, that they would go sue, that they would sue us in the event. And we've done these special things in our procedures to make sure people are asking the right questions, and we have a complete loan application, that we haven't left anything off the table for determining their ability to repay. As long as we've done all that right, perhaps my legal risk hasn't really changed all that much. So that's that's where I think that they're at right now.
Andy, Prophet Doctor, do you want to add to that?
Well, I think Alice said it perfectly. It, you know, having a qualified underwriting decision that considered the borrower's ability to repay is something that bid lenders have been doing forever. This isn't just that they've made it into a regulation, but being able to document those things or have been there for a long time. So I don't really see this as it's putting teeth behind an activity that we should have been doing anyway. And if we were doing it anyway, we're already good at it. As long as we document that we've done it, then I don't see it as substantially different than the way we've been doing business before. But I'd be curious about Alice's points on that, though.
Well, I think what's different is, well, Andy, you know as well as I do, when you talk to some of the companies in a portfolio, you know, they have credit committee and there's five people in a, sitting in a room going, well, yeah, they're a great depositor, let's give them a loan again, and the documentation may not have been there in the past. So I would say you can't make concessions on documentation anymore. If you're looking for a place to take a shortcut or take additional risk in a portfolio loan, you still have it fully documented. Credit income, right?
And I would say that every portfolio loan should be secondary marketing eligible on every regard as it relates to documentation.
Very good.
Maybe there's
very
pricing
good.
Strategies
yeah.
that are different, but otherwise, and we've been preaching that to banks forever. If there are banks that are shortcutting documentation, then I think that's a big mistake.
It's a big, big mistake. Well, you know what? Someone tested me, and they said, hey, is Joe Farr a potted plant on your show, or are we going to hear from Joe?
Hey, Joe. Joe, we know you have a ton of
Joe, we know you're not a potted plant. You're valuable. We've been
right.
following. We've got 3 minutes left before we're out the door here. So take it away, Joe. What are your thoughts on all this? You're a vendor. I mean, you don't get hacked. You don't have customer data. So you're a little bit different than an LMA for certain. But, you know, love to get your thoughts on everything we talked about, and then we'll wrap up the broadcast.
Well, number one, Alice asked the right question. What can a little mortgage banker do? They go to Ellie Mae because they're the biggest. They go to Ellie Mae because they expect they're secure. They've got their SAS 70. They've done what they need to do. I don't see how a small mortgage banker can affect that. I mean, Ellie Mae doesn't want 150 different auditing firms to come in and review their systems. So something's got to be done other than little mortgage companies going in to ensure compliance or security. But, maybe that is Ellie Mae hires their own group to come in and issue the opinions, but they've done that. I don't know where you go from there. I wanted to bring up this whole thing about cost of compliance and profitability. I mean, if you look at the fourth quarter profit per loan per the MBA analysis, shockingly $150 per loan. Think about how many loans you have to make in order to pay for the risk on one bad loan. It's 200 or more.
Yeah.
And given those economics, you've got to be pretty good at everything you do. But that's not sustainable. So, you know, the issue of regulatory costs and compliance, I applaud. I don't know if anything good will come from it, but the Financial Services Committee is asking the question of regulators, have you really analyzed the cost and benefit of some of these new regulations to the consumer, for the consumer? Because, you know, the consumer's paying a lot of this. Some of it's coming out of the bottom line of the company. But the consumer's paying a lot of the costs that go into all these regulations and the ability to go in and audit Ellie Mae and other vendors. Things have to change from the perspective of sustaining the industry.
It really does. We're out of time, folks, and it's just there's a lot of thought. I've had several people during this course of this broadcast, as Dave, please continue this discussion one more week. So we're going to, folks. Next week it's going to continue with this format. the way we have this week. So be sure to tune back. There's a lot more topics. I've been emailed and asked about reverse mortgages, HECMs. That came up. The cost of compliance has come up. We've had several requests emailed to me about the homeownership counseling disclosure, like they've never heard about it, Alice. So we are going to continue this discussion, and get the word out to your friends on it. We appreciate you tuning in and being a part of this broadcast. Next week, we are going to have a brief word of guest appearance by Jeff Schumer of the MBA, Campus MBA, talking about a new training program that they have up. It complements what Alice does, so be sure to tune in on that. Appreciate you being a part of the broadcast, telling others about this thing called Lickin' on Lending, and we appreciate you being a part of it. Special thank you goes out to our sponsors. Again, UG, United Guarantee, as well as Velma.com. Also, thank you, Andy, Alice, and Joe, for being a part of this each and every week. Have a great week, everybody.
This has been Lickin' on Lending, a weekly mortgage market update with your host, David Lickin of Mortgage Banking Solutions, enabling executives to take their business to the next level. Today's guests were Joe Farr from MBS Quoteline, Andy Schell of Mortgage Banking Solutions, and Alice Elvey, President CMB of Mortgage U. Come by next week, and thank you for listening.